Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. Also your hosts on our website and podcast throughout the week. Trying to keep everybody as up to date as we can on macro events for the markets, but then even more so driving down into market moves and company updates. Still a lot of news coming out broadly. The problem seems to be is that every sector seems to be under a bit of pressure here. We are kicking off the show, first two segments, with our good friend Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Jesse, we have to start with the Fed, whether you like it or not. We had a Fed meeting this week, and we actually saw volatility before the Fed meeting, and then even more volatility after the Fed meeting. To sum it up, the Fed hiked rates by 50 basis points, what they have been guiding for. One of the noteworthy comments from Jerome Powell is that he said that the committee really wasn't even discussing 75 basis point hikes. That's something that the market was more forcing on the Fed. Let's start there with the general Fed statement and Powell's press conference. What was your takeaway, Jesse?
Well, my takeaway was Powell just blinked, right? Powell likes to say that he's up to the task of being Paul Volcker if necessary. And he's clearly not. I mean, right now, inflation is running so high and the Fed is so far behind the curve that what he should be saying is we're going to do whatever it takes to rein in inflation, period. We are going to raise interest rates. If it causes a recession, so be it. If it causes the stock market to crash, so be it. We have to rein in inflation. And he didn't do that by taking 75 basis points off the table. That is basically, you know, saying the opposite of whatever it takes. No, we're only willing to raise at a rate that, you know, will not crash the stock market, will not hurt the economy. So I think that you know, the market, Powell blinked, and I think that's what the markets are trying to suss out. I think probably what that means, and the bond market is really telling that story, right? I think bond investors, by selling bonds off so hard in the last few days in the wake of the Fed meeting, that's bond investors saying, wait, if you're not fully dedicated to reining in inflation, how can we buy bonds at a 3% yield? It makes no sense.
Well, Jesse, that's a great point, because with inflation at around 8.5% on the last CPI reading, even if the Fed was to hike not just 75 basis points, but let's say 100 basis points four or five times, we'd still have negative real rates for inflation adjusted rates. So I guess if you're in the bond market, you think, why would I want to hold on to something that's guaranteed to lose money? And so we've seen interest rates really spike up even higher on a percentage basis. What do you think the higher interest rates or the rising rates are going to do to other markets like real estate or to the general equities?
Well, I think, you know, what the bond market is upset with, I mean, let's try and quantify this, right? The Fed funds rate is still below 1%, right? We're still not even at 100 basis points at a time when the Taylor rule says the Fed should be over 1,000 basis points. We should have a 10% Fed funds rate today with where the economy is, with where inflation is, and all of these things. So the Fed has never been so far behind the curve. So it makes absolute perfect sense that bond investors would be paying very close attention to how dedicated the Fed is into, you know, in protecting the stable prices side of the mandate. And if Jay Powell says, we will do whatever it takes, great. Okay, maybe I can buy bonds at 3. But if they're not, then you can't buy bonds, right? Because if inflation is going to remain elevated because the Fed is dedicated to remaining behind the curve, which is the message I took from the latest Fed meeting and the message they've given for months and quarters now, you know, then you have to stay away from bonds because inflation is going to remain elevated. And really what Jay Powell's dealing with is an incredibly difficult situation, right? We're already seeing tons of signs that we're headed for recession. The oil price up 50% year over year. Every time that happens, we go into recession. Yield curve, I mean, I think we talked about all this stuff the last time I was on. Look at the relative performance of retail stocks, relative performance of small caps. Everything is pointing to recession. CNBC ran a poll this week. 80% of small businesses expect recession before the end of this year. 80%. And so because the Fed waited so long to tighten, Now they're going to be forced to tighten into a recession, into a downturn. And I just don't think Jay Powell's up to the task. I think already we're seeing slowing in the housing market because mortgage rates have ripped higher over 5% from, you know, below 3 not too long ago. So, you know, home builders, another stock that's shown significant relative underperformance leading to the downside of the stock market. All signs, you know, red flags for recession. And so, I mean, you can't blame Jay for saying, you know, I can't now tighten. I can't normalize policy. If they were to go to 3% on the Fed funds or 3.5, like some have been talking about, and, you know, roll off $2 to $3 trillion on the balance sheet, it would crash the markets, would crash the economy. He knows this, which is why he backed off, at the meeting from saying those things, because he knows he can't afford to do that.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is the markets and the economy are addicted to all of this free money because they've had it for so long, and that's what helps support markets and economies when you just keep bumping that money out. We're in a different environment right now. One more question regarding interest rates, though. Even though 3% is way behind the curve, it is generally higher than the rest of the world. And the way that a lot of big money managers are set up is that they need to have some money in sovereign bonds. It does make the U.S. look more attractive, though, doesn't it? Even though it's lagging behind general inflation.
Well, absolutely. And this is why the dollar's been so strong is one, you know, we've had some of the high, you know, higher interest rates. I mean, you look at Japan and Europe and you go, I can't, you know, I mean, it's silly. So U.S. nominal rates look much more attractive than those other areas around the world. And the other side of that is the Fed has outlined through forward guidance a very hawkish path, right? I mean, they are talking about going to, you know, 2.5-3% on Fed funds in a very short period of time. They've talked about, rolling $2-3 trillion off the balance sheet. And so relative to other central banks, I mean, relative to the Bank of Japan, it's a joke. The Fed is off the charts hawkish. And relative to the ECB, they're relatively hawkish. And so if you were to say who's protecting the purchasing power of the currency better, you'd have to say it's the Fed right now, at least in talk, at least in terms of forward guidance. Now, at some point, and I think, you know, we're very rapidly approaching this point, the Fed is going to be, you know, tasked with, okay, follow through on that guidance and risk crashing the stock market, risk, you know, exacerbating a very deep recession. And, you know, the Jay Powell's going to either have to say, yes, I'm Paul Volcker and I'm going to do this, or no, we can't afford to normalize policy. And at that point, I think gold is already kind of sniffing out that Powell blinked at this meeting. And that's why, you know, the gold price has kind of bottomed and rebounded over the last few days. But if he officially pivots, I think before he does, the dollar and the gold price will already have sniffed that out and have, you know, the dollar rolled over and the gold price broken out to new highs.
Well, Jesse, it's interesting you bring that up because I was going to ask you how the dollar was possibly affecting commodities as we've seen the dollar shoot higher. And it has shot to a couple year high recently, currently up at 103.63. It's pressured the commodity sector, which was ripping higher, not just on supply chain and not just on Ukraine, but just on the inflation. So a lot of things pushing energy higher, the base metals higher, agricultural products higher, but they have rolled over some as the dollar strengthened. Do you expect that dollar to top out soon? And do you think that would coincide with the rebound in the commodity sector?
I do. I think if we are headed for recession, the dollar's going to top out just because the Fed's going to be forced to, rein in the hawkish talk. I mean, you look at the last time the dollar put in a major peak in, you know, late 16, early 17, and the economy started weakening into the, you know, late 2018 dollar rolled over and put it in an important low. I think we're approaching kind of a similar scenario, from a technical standpoint, that the dollar's back to those highs of late 16, early 17, and running into technical resistance there. But I think when Jay Powell doesn't just blink, but does pivot, the dollar's going to roll over. And So then commodities are kind of interesting at that point, right? Commodities have been really strong, even in the face of a strong dollar, which is very impressive. I mean, it tells you, tells me how strong demand for, you know, commodities are, and how strong the fundamentals are in terms of supply and demand. But if we go into recession, right, that's not a great thing for commodities. But if you get a rollover in the dollar, it could, you know, help limit some of the damage to commodities prices if they roll over together at the same time. I think generally longer term, commodities are still undervalued. The supply demand dynamic is still very bullish. But we could see, you know, like just like in any bull market, you know, a two steps forward, one step back type of thing. And that might be what we see in commodities going forward, as they've had, you know, a bunch of steps forward off the lows, you know, 18 months ago or whatever. And you know, we might be due for some type of a correction.
Jesse, even after this run in commodities, you can still make the argument, as you just did, that commodities are undervalued compared to financial assets, even though financial assets are under even more pressure. But commodities have been undervalued for more than a decade now. Why has this happened? Why is this hanging around for so long, even after the recent bump in commodities?
Well, I mean, it goes back to the capital cycle, right? When commodity prices are high, it's just, you know, the remedy for, you know, high prices is high prices, and vice versa, right? When you get high prices, the greed that it stimulates among producers is, unstoppable. They go produce as much as they possibly can. Market gets oversupplied, and that takes years to work that out. And vice versa, on the other side, we've had a commodity price crash, right? Oil prices went negative. We had all commodities in the toilet for a number of years. The gold price crashed from 2011 to 2015. And that instills a lot of discipline, right? I mean, nobody wants to invest in expanding supplies when prices are in the dumps. And so that takes years to work itself out too. And we're still seeing, I mean, look at like energy, right? Oil prices are still really high. And, you know, some people are saying it's discipline that's holding back the oil and gas producers. It might just be that, you know, a lot of the shale plays aren't as prolific, you know, in terms of being able to produce as a lot of people have assumed. And so, you know, you look at like drilled and uncompleted wells and those types of things, and those numbers are in free fall. So we might need much higher commodities prices and sustained for a long period of time to really kind of create that type of supply response you normally see that helps put in a peak for commodities. I think really the only thing to realize right now is we're nowhere close to that time. We're not seeing any producers in any of these things get to a point where they're able to create a supply response to prices.
Jesse, I think that's a solid point, because there's been chronic underinvestment in the oil and gas space for over a decade, as banks were told not to invest in them, as ESG companies said, let's stay out of that. You know, they killed coal. They didn't want to touch uranium. And we've seen all those energy sources now spiking. So now people are finally investing in projects, but it does take time to get them back online. Same thing with the base metals. But one of the metals I think we should talk about is gold. You'd mentioned it briefly earlier, but the precious metals are a little bit different category of commodity, because they really are monetary metals. They're really money itself. And so they tend to react as a safe haven. Gold has done well overall, all things considered, but it has pulled back quite a bit. And you mentioned you thought it may just start bouncing recently after this Fed kind of blinking. What do you think, I guess, in the medium term, the picture is for gold, and what will get more interest into the sector to maybe push it out and break it out to new highs?
Well, I was just asking, I literally just got off recording a podcast myself with my friend Fred Hickey, who's one of the, you know, he writes the high tech strategist, but he's easily as brilliant when it comes to investing in precious metals as with high tech stocks. And so, we were just talking about this, and he makes a great point that, you know, the biggest buyers of precious metals, you know, physical, are, you know, Indians and Chinese. Chinese are in lockdown. And the Indians, you know, really follow a seasonal pattern. And so that's why gold prices kind of follow a seasonal pattern. And it goes, we're in the weak period for seasonal strength right now. And it doesn't improve until late summer, August, something like that sometime. And, you know, so that's one factor. I think the biggest factor, though, in my opinion, I mean, I to be honest, I look at the gold strength. Look at the gold price over the last 6-9 months. It's up. At the same time, the dollar has been ripping higher. I mean, gone essentially parabolic, the dollar has in the last couple of months. And what's driving the dollar? It's those higher interest rates here in the U.S., which are actually now becoming less attractive because the cost of hedging against currency exposure is becoming so expensive, especially for Japanese. So, you know, that's being limited some. But it's also just, like I mentioned, Fed policy, right? The dollar strength comes back to the Fed outlining the most hawkish tightening path that we've seen since Paul Volcker. Essentially, the dollar is pricing in that we have Paul Volcker at the helm again today. And I think when the markets come around to the idea that Jay Powell is no Paul Volcker, the dollar is going to reverse, and that hawkish rhetoric, rising interest rates, all of these things that have been holding the gold price back are going to lift and they're going to go away. I think we're probably close to a top in yields as well because of a lot of this. And so if that's the case, then, you know, gold could be, and technically it looks like this too, that we've had a breakout out of its, you know, consolidating phase, that kind of pennant pattern. You know, we broke out to new highs and now the price has fallen back to test that breakout. It's just a classic breakout, test, and go. And now I think we're just looking at that go phase for gold, which will be, I think a very strong up phase for the gold price over the next, you know, few years.
It really has been encouraging to see gold really set up a higher trading range right now, a historically higher trading range. The problem being the stocks are really struggling, though, especially the juniors and the mid-tiers. We saw some pretty significant production and cost misses just this week from earnings from some of the mid-tiers. And Newmont, largest miner, it was at all-time highs, but has pulled back from there. Why are the stocks so weak then, Jesse, if gold is looking so good?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is, you know, margin compression, right? We've seen the gold price correct for 2 years now, something like that. So top line has been, you know, not as strong because the gold price has not been not as strong. And at the same time, you know, expenses have been rising along with everybody else. I mean, you know, diesel costs, employment costs, all of these things are rising. And so margins have been come under pressure. And I think that just goes through phases, right? I mean, we could see a time ahead when margins, you know, rapidly expand, and that's just would come through top line growth and then, you know, resolving of some of these kind of margin pressures, expenses. But I think really the main thing with the gold stocks, the problem that they have is I think investors are doubting that gold is still in a bull market. And when you look at how, you know, cyclical, because the stocks are incredibly cheap, you know, you look at my favorite right now is Agnico Eagle, and it's trading at probably about a 50% discount to its historical valuation. And the only way a stock should trade that cheap is if you were at the top of the cycle, right? If you think about cyclical companies, their earnings look great at the top and look terrible at the bottom. So you really should only be willing to pay a, you know, kind of a low PE at the top, and you want to pay, you know, when the stocks look cheap, the price earnings ratio looks really high because earnings are so depressed. And so I think people look at the gold miners, see they have low PEs, but they're like, yeah, but we're at the top of the cycle. And if the gold price rolls over, earnings are going to get destroyed. And so I can't own the miners. But if it's my belief that we're not near the top of the cycle in the gold price, in fact, it's just the opposite. There's so many things that I look at in terms of gold. I mean, look at gold relative to the money supply. It's just as cheap as it was in 2015 at the lows relative to the money supply. You look at the commitment of traders report and look at gold producers, breakout producers, and they're literally selling forward the least amount of product that they have since 2018 and 2015, 16 before that. So you have the smart money, the smartest of smart money, selling, you know, hey, we're not going to hedge any production. We're that confident in higher prices, over the next several quarters that we don't need to sell forward any product. So, I mean, there's so many things that tell me we're not anywhere near the top of the cycle in the gold price that the stocks are not value traps, you know, in which they would be cheap for a very good reason. I think they're unduly cheap. And, when the gold price breaks out to new highs, the miners, you know, are going to double, triple, quadruple the performance of the gold price just because they're so cheap right now.
Well, Jesse, I'm sure some of the listeners hearing those comments are going to be happy to hear that, as they may sit in some of those undervalued mining stocks right now. I know some of us sure do. But I guess just as a thought on the what you're doing currently, until we see this Fed policy play through and until we see that potential Powell pivot, how are you playing the markets currently? Where are you putting your capital to work, or are you going to cash right now? What's your strategy in the short to medium term?
Well, I think because I've been, you know, obviously it's going to be a Powell pivot that's going to be the catalyst for much higher gold prices. And I think we're getting very close to that point. And like I said, I think he blinked at the last meeting, and because he, you know, demurred from saying, you know, we are not going to do whatever it takes. I mean, that's the what you can read between the lines. We're not willing to do whatever it takes to rein in inflation. So before he actually pivots, gold price will have already broken out. So I think right now we're probably very close to an important low in the gold price, just because I think we're now transitioning from this time when Powell blinked to where he's actually going to pivot. And the dollar is very close to a top. I mean, this week could be an important top. We'll look back at you know, all the headlines we've seen about dollar strength, and I've seen it everywhere. You know, the importance of this Fed meeting as, you know, one of those times you look back and I go, well, of course the dollar topped out. That was the last hawkish meeting. You know, because I think we'll see over the next month, it's one of the reasons why I believe interest rates could be close to topping out too, is that we're going to get more and more data. And the first quarter already showed negative real growth in GDP. If it becomes clear that this current quarter is going to be another two consecutive quarters of negative real growth, more and more people are going to start worrying about recession. You know, we've already had Ken Rogoff, you know, came out and said recession's already foregone conclusion. It's just, you know, how deep is it going to be? And I think you have a lot of former Fed officials, whether it's Dudley or, you know, whatever. The idea of the soft landing is absurd. So more markets are coming around to the idea that we're already headed for recession. And as we get more and more data that confirms that, it's going to put pressure on the dollar. It's going to put, you know, potentially a bid under bonds. And it's going to make it more and more obvious that Powell is getting ready to pivot.
All right, Jesse, we're wrapping it up here. A lot of recession talk continues, and rightfully so, as we are seeing markets continue to break down. And it's dragging a lot of other asset classes down with it. And now we're also seeing weaker economic data. So not a pretty picture this year for markets or the economy. We'll see if the Fed switches course sooner rather than later. We'll see if we get a little reprieve from all this bad data. But right now, it's been a tough start to the year. Jesse, thank you, as always, for your time. It's great having you on the show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And we'll chat again next month.
Thanks, guys. Talk soon.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first few segments with Jesse Felder, really covering big picture markets, big picture themes. In these segments, we are chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. Also going to be chatting about the Fed and some big picture themes, but then also outlining what is in the CPM Group's Silver Yearbook, which is releasing next week. There is also an event May 10th at 10 a.m. where Jeff is hosting to go over the Silver Yearbook and talk about some of the big picture themes. Jeff, I want to start with the markets and even more importantly, the Fed. The Fed this week came out as expected with a 50 basis point rate hike.
Powell pretty much said, look, they're not even talking about a 75 basis point hike, which it seems like the market got a little bit ahead of itself on the back of that announcement. Boy, oh boy, are we seeing some volatility. Jeff, what caught your eye about the Fed policy statement and what Powell had to say in his press conference?
I think that the major thing was, we were completely discounting the idea of a 75 basis point increase. And we were saying, given the low, the negative 1.4% real GDP figure for the first quarter that came out last Friday, and given the increased violence in the Ukraine-Russian war, we thought it might even be possible that they would be more cautious. So I think, our big takeaway is, no, the Fed thinks that the economy is strong enough and that inflation is problematic enough to raise rates 50 basis points, even given that. So that tells us that they think that they can sterilize the inflation that we're seeing in the market over the next, several quarters, the next year or two, without throwing us into a recession, at least in the near future, or triggering a recession. So I think that that was the big takeaway. And then the follow-up was the very interesting view that the market seemed to have that same interpretation, where they said, okay, the Fed is raising interest rates 50 basis points, but they feel that the economy can handle it. So the economy is stronger than a lot of the doomsayers are saying that it is, and that we're probably not, already one quarter into a recession. So I think that that was the big takeaway for me.
Well, Jeff, that's an interesting point to bring up, because we have heard the word recession showing up more and more in interviews we do, but also in articles that you read online and other people's interviews. It seems like with the slowdown in GDP last quarter, mixed with the high inflation and some market turbulence, I mean, the general markets have been a little weaker in the first quarter and moving into the second quarter, that we're hearing that a lot. But there is that confidence that we're seeing just in the recent past that maybe the Fed can stay the course. I mean, what do you think it would take for the Fed to trigger a recession? What would have to happen? Would inflation not have to come down enough, or would they get a couple more hikes in maybe midsummer or maybe into the fall and realize, uh-oh, maybe we've gone too far? What would it take to make the doomsayers correct, let's say?
Yeah, it's funny, because I guess the working title I have right now is that hyperbole has killed more investors than Cecil B. DeMille. If you look at it, there's a lot of yellow journalism abroad, and it's not just the doomsayers, it's also the mainstream press. So, Deutsche Bank came out with a report a couple of weeks ago, and they said, look, we could have a recession starting in 2023. And all of the headlines were, Deutsche Bank sees the recession. And you had to read into the fifth paragraph to say, oh, it might be 12 months from now before you see that one. I do think that, as we've been talking about the probability of a recession sometime a couple years down the road, and we still think it's there. And it's not that the Fed would throw the country into a recession per se, but that economic activity would get to a point where the supply-demand balance is so tight that it could trigger much higher inflation, much higher interest rates, and ultimately a recession. And I think what the Fed is saying is that it's looking at the tightening, and there is a tremendous amount of supply constraints right now. And that's a problem, because that's something that the Fed can't really control. The Fed can raise interest rates, they can suck money out of the economy. All of that's pretty much on the demand side of the economy. But right now, what you're seeing is a combination of very strong demand across segments of the economy, coupled with supply constraints. And the real problem that the Fed is facing is, how do you deal with those supply constraints? Because that's nothing that, supply is much less elastic to interest rate changes than is demand. So that's one of the big concerns. And what I think the Fed was saying was, supply constraints are a problem, but there is enough growth left on the demand side that we don't think that, there'll be a recessionary condition right now. And if you look at what happened in the first quarter, the reality is that consumer demand and some other aspects of business demand were still relatively strong. And what you really saw was a reduction in inventory holdings on the part of business. And that, in fact, that in turn reflected the supply constraints. And it also reflected the fact that the businesses are saying, hey, we're in a tough place here, and we have to be very prudent with our financial resources. So, you know, you put all that together and you say, okay, the Fed probably thinking that there's more rope to let out in the economy before we hit into more serious constraints on the supply-demand balance that would trigger higher inflation, higher interest rates, and ultimately run a greater risk of a recession.
Really sounds like an almost tightrope walk that the Fed is doing here, trying to control the demand side, but then not having control over the supply side, especially when you consider what's going on in China and really the rest of the world. A lot of supply restrictions and constraints out there. Jeff, what about the reaction in the markets? Because it was one thing that the Fed hasn't been trying to trick investors. They have been pretty upfront and giving a lot of heads up on when they're hiking rates and the process that they're going to be hiking rates. This whole 75 basis point rate hike was really generated by the market and market moves prior to that meeting. That being said, though, boy, oh boy, did we get some volatility on the back of the statement and press conference. Markets went up a lot Wednesday afternoon, and Thursday, as we're recording this, about halfway through the day, boy, oh boy, they've given up all of those gains, and we're seeing pretty much a bloodbath. We see the U.S. dollar up, which is up quite strongly, and yields, 10-year, it's over 3%. So we are seeing a run higher in yields and the U.S. dollar, but we are seeing crashing markets and really every sector being pulled down with it. So what's your takeaway from this market reaction?
First off, I do want to say the Fed's always walking a tightrope. And, you know, the Fed for like more than 20 years, probably close to 40 years, has been saying to the Congress in its Humphrey Hawkins talks and to the administration, we can only do so much with monetary policy. You have to get your fiscal house in order. And in fact, the government has gone the other way, and its fiscal house is in much worse shape now than it ever has been in history. You know, so the Fed's sort of like, you know, the surgeon who's got a patient who says, I take cocaine, I drink like a skunk, and I chain smoke cigarettes. Keep me well. You know, and you say, well, you know, I can give you some medicines and I can prescribe, you know, exercise, but you really need to stop smoking, stop drinking so much, and stop taking cocaine. And the federal government says, you know, hey, I'm not paying you to tell me how to live my life. I'm paying you to make me well. And that's sort of where the Fed is, you know, metaphorically. You know, the market reaction was interesting. And I have to say this, yes, the Dow Jones is off 1,000 points right now. It is as low today as it was in March. Let me repeat that. It's as low today as it was in March. The reality is that, yes, it's off 1,000 points, but, you know, it also has a lot of scope to go down and also to go back up. So I think that the markets and, you know, the idea that the dollar is up sharply only makes sense given, A, the higher interest rates in the United States relative to everybody else, B, the relatively greater strength in the U.S. economy relative to everybody else. You know, so I think that that kind of makes sense. Like I said, you know, one of the big surprises for me was that a 50-point basis increase in interest rates and the associated rhetoric that came with it was enough to cause the markets to sort of say, hey, we're not about to throw ourselves off the abyss into a recession, you know, so that alarmism that you're hearing from the doomsday people is probably a little bit premature, you know, and I think that that's one of the things that you're finding in the markets right now. You know, another thing, point I'd make is obviously the Fed watches to see how the markets react to its behavior, but contrary to what some people say, the Fed doesn't, you know, cue off of the stock market. The Fed cues off of the economy. It looks at a tremendous range of economic data, and the Dow Jones and stock market prices are one of the things that it probably pays the least attention to. It's very tuned into the idea that it wants to know how the markets are reacting to its behavior, but it doesn't behave in order to stimulate a certain outcome on the part of the markets. It behaves in order to try to quell inflation and maximize employment. And that's what it's doing right now, as the best as it can, given the fiscal imbalances, a war in which Russia is invading the Ukraine and threatening to broaden it into a nuclear holocaust for the world, COVID coming back, $30 trillion debt built up in the U.S. economy, and a dysfunctional government. You know, so that's where we're at.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of spinning plates in the air that they've got to keep track of. But the Fed's focus really is, like you mentioned, the health of the economy, the labor markets. How is the producers, manufacturers indexes doing? You know, how is the growth of the economy and the GDP? They're looking at all that, not just the stock market. But we have seen some weakness in the general markets, Jeff. And we hear the narrative in the precious metal space that for gold and ultimately maybe silver to get a bid, that we're going to have to see kind of a bifurcation where the markets start to roll over some and then the precious metals markets get a bid. And I know there's differing opinions on that, but what is your thoughts on that? Do we need to see not a crash, but just a rollover in the general markets and more weakness for more generalist investors to maybe go into gold as more of a safe haven play? What's your thought on that?
I'm not quite sure. You know, first off, you know, statistically, it's not necessary to see the stock market fall for investors to turn back to gold and silver. That said, if the stock market did fall 20% or something like that, and the, you know, today it's off 2%, 2 or 3%. If the stock market did fall 20% or so, I think that that might help stimulate some growth in investment demand for gold and silver, but it's not a prerequisite for it, you know? And quite frankly, you have periods of time where gold and silver investment demand and prices do very well while the stock market is high and rising. Because when the stock market is high and people are, as they are now, very nervous about, you know, a correction or a bear market, which might see a 20% decline, or if you listen to the gold bugs, you know, the end of civilization as we know it and an 80% decline in the stock market. When people have a lot of money in highly priced stock markets, and they're worried about a decline, that oftentimes is a time when they're buying a lot of gold and silver. So, you know, to say that you need to lower stock prices to stimulate investment demand for gold and silver is not actually accurate, because oftentimes what you see is when the stock market moves higher, investors buy more gold and silver because they want to have a certain portion of their portfolio in diversified assets like gold and silver. And as the value of their stock portfolio rises, they need to buy more gold and silver to maintain that portion of their portfolio that's in safe haven assets, if you will.
That is true. Using it as a store of value, right? When you make profits, rotate some of those profits into maybe something a bit safer. The problem is, as we look at the screen, as I said, man, everything is red today. The precious metals were up, but boy, oh boy, the stocks are selling off. Jeff, let's talk a little bit about silver, because as I mentioned, the Silver Yearbook launching next week, May 10th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. You have your event to break down what you're seeing in the silver market, your forecast, and this yearbook launch. Can you give us a general overview of, first of all, where you see silver right now and what some of the big themes are around that metal?
I think the biggest thing that we're paying attention to with silver is investment demand, as always, you know. And we saw investment demand rise very sharply from, like, you know, 38 million ounces in 2019 to about 97 million ounces last year. And that has caused the silver price, you know, the average price to go from $16 to $25 last year. And right now, as we're talking, it's about $22.50. So we think we're bullish on silver, and that we think that the price will move sideways to higher from here over the next, say, six quarters, but trading basically between $21 and, say, $28 over the next year and a half, and then with the potential to rise much more sharply. You know, we're actually looking, you know, based on the first 4 months of this year, we're looking at a slight decline in investment demand for silver, so slightly lower prices possibly on an annual average basis this year compared to where we were last year. But the reality is that, you know, investors have rediscovered silver over the last 3 years. They are buying more silver. They probably will continue to buy silver because it is in a bull market and it seems to have a lot further to go than, say, the stock market.
Well, Jeff, it's interesting that you're focused on the investment demand because, as we've heard for decades, that, you know, the prices are set at the periphery, the prices are set at the margins, and that really comes from the investor demand. But we also hear a secondary narrative that, hey, it's a hybrid metal. It's really an industrial metal now. It's really more of a base metal. It's not money anymore. It was dethroned as money in the 1800s. It's not like gold. It doesn't get the safe haven bid as gold. And so the narrative seems to shift from it's just a poor old industrial metal to no. It really will track gold. It really is money, and it really will be, there really is investment demand. So how do you balance out the narrative with this hybrid metal of silver?
Well, unlike a lot of these guys, I've only been in the silver market since the 1970s. And I have always focused primarily on investment demand as the key factor determining silver prices. Yeah. So it really is. Yeah. Silver investors are the marginal buyers or sellers of silver. And they don't even have to be in the silver market. They can go play in other markets. If you're a fabricator and you're making solar panels or electronics or brazing alloys and solders or jewelry or silverware or mirrors, you know, or photography, you need to use silver and you're going to buy silver. So you're relatively less price elastic than, say, an investor. The same is true on the supply side. So so it's really the investors who are the marginal buyers and sellers of silver. And they're really the guys who sort of set the pace, the timing, and the level of silver price changes. And so it's very important. Now, that said, you know, in gold, you've got maybe, 40 million ounces out of 100 million ounces of newly refined supply that comes into the gold market every year that goes into investment demand. Yeah, right now it's probably closer to 20 million ounces, but it's still, let's say, 20%. In silver, it's a much smaller thing. So you might have, you know, this year we expect silver's total supply from scrap as well as mine production to be just shy of 1 billion ounces. And we expect investment demand to be about 76 million ounces. So investment demand is about 7.5% of total supply in the silver market. So while it is the marginal demand that determines the price, you do have a much more important influence on the price set by fabrication demand. And, you know, in fabrication demand, it's been relatively flat. I mean, we actually saw about a 6% decline in 2000. It came back up about 2% last year, but it didn't get back to the levels that we saw prior to the pandemic and the lockdown. We think it's going to continue to expand this year, but at a relatively modest pace. So we don't see total fabrication demand getting back to 2018, 2019 levels this year. But it's moving in that direction. And one of the big drivers is solar panels. And solar panels are particularly important now because people are trying to get away from fossil fuels. And solar electricity is probably the most cost competitive renewable that's around there right now compared to, say, wind or other forms of renewable energy. So you're going to continue to see strong demand for silver in solar panels. You probably will see a revival in electronics as the economy continues to expand for a while. So we see fabrication demand strong. But again, you know, if you really wanted to, you know, it wasn't fabrication demand that drove the silver price from $16 in 2019 to $20 in 2020 and $25 last year. It was investment demand. In fact, as I just said, you saw fabrication demand falling during that time, partly because the price of silver was rising, but mostly because of the recession in 2020 and the constraints on economic output ever since then. So it's really that investment demand that you have to pay attention to. Fabrication demand is good. It provides a very solid base for silver, silver demand and silver offtake and silver prices, but it's really the investment demand that drives this car.
So, Jeff, do you agree with the narrative that higher prices lead to higher prices, unlike fabrication demand, where if prices rise too much, we could actually see a slowdown in fabrication? Investment demand, are you on that boat that says higher prices are good to lead to more higher prices?
up to a certain point. I mean, you know, you'll see investment demand for gold and silver. Investors are like the opposite of price elastic. You know, so they, when the price is falling, they tend not to buy as much. And when the price is rising, they chase the price higher. So as the price has risen, you've seen investment demand increase. And that will continue up to a certain point. But what we've seen over and over again, we saw it in the 1980s, we saw it after 2011, we've seen it in the last couple of years, is when the price of silver gets too high, A, you have any number of investors who are willing to take profits and sell their silver, and B, other investors say, I'm not going to buy at these prices. So there is a price elasticity, and we've seen the price of silver, you know, run up to $50 twice in 1980 and again in 2011. And both times, the price of silver came down with a thud. You know, in 1980, the price of silver fell more than 50% in one day. And until 2020, when the oil price fell more than 50% in one day, I had never seen another commodity lose half of its value in one day.
All right, Jeff, we're out of time for this weekend show. Thank you for joining us for the last couple segments there and sharing your thoughts on where the Fed is, where the metals are going, and a little insights into silver. Everybody, thank you for tuning in this weekend. It's been great putting the show together, albeit in a pretty tough market. I know we're all looking at stocks that continue to sell off, but that seems to be every sector. So something to consider. It's been a bad start to the year for U.S. equity markets, also a tough start to the year for a number of other sectors. We'll all be back with you early next week. So please keep in touch with Shad and I, Fleck@KEReport.com and Shad@KEReport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you, and we hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.KEReport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.